Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps, episode 130 for August 11th, 2010, VirtualBox. It's time for Floss Weekly, the weekly show about free, libre, open source software. Weekly as in I'm here weekly, your host, Randall Schwartz, talking to you about the projects that are interesting, the people that make the important open source decisions and conclusions and presentations and stuff. And speaking of people who make important decisions and presentations and stuff, I want to bring in right now my co-host, Simon Phipps. Simon, hello.
Hello, Randall. Greetings to you over there in LA from me down here in the south of England in Southampton. It's great to be on the show again.
And a slightly different look behind you there. You must be in a new dig, apparently.
Yes, so I've got a new job here. You can see Forge Rock is the name of the company, and this is our world engineering headquarters down here in the cabin at the foot of my garden.
And I'm lucky again to be at my main client in LA, Oversea.net, graciously giving me a space to hold it in. And if you're watching the video, you may actually see this weird-looking diagram behind me here, and it claims to be the web trend map 4. I don't know what happened to 1 through 3, but... It's mapped on top of the Tokyo subway system. What a strange way to kind of overlay the video for that. But that's where I am, and that's why you're seeing me with this weird background behind me. Anyway, so this show today, I have been looking forward to for quite a while, and I'm really glad it got set up. Aaron Newcomb got this set up for me, and he couldn't be here on this week's show. So, Simon, thank you for stepping up at the last moment to be a co-host for me. That's really, really appreciate that. We've got with us the VirtualBox guys. We actually have with us Andy Hall, who is the product manager for Oracle VM VirtualBox. And we also have Akeem Hassenmuller, who is one of the lead architects. Actually, I think he's been around with it since even before it was owned by Sun and owned by Oracle. So really good to get these guys on. They'll be on in just a second. Well, let me say what VirtualBox is. Some people need to listen. VirtualBox is a virtual machine. It allows you to run your guest operating system inside a host. So, for example, on my OS X machine here, I can run VirtualBox and install Linux or FreeBSD or even Windows-ish and run them in parallel, essentially. So I can be running a full operating system inside a full operating system. So very happy with all that. So anything you want to say before we get into the show, Simon?
Not really. The only thing I should tell the viewers and listeners is that I used to work at Sun, and so I was part of the management team that helped acquire this company back a couple of years ago. So they may look kind of scared to see me being the co-host. They might not have been expecting that.
Well, okay. We'll see how scary you are. You're not that scary, really. You're like a big teddy bear. It's all good. It'll be fine. All right. So without further ado, let's go ahead and bring our guests on. First, let's speak to Andy. Andy, where are we speaking to you from?
Hey, I'm based up in the UK in the Republic of Yorkshire in a city called Leeds.
Cool. I don't know where any of that is, except I know it's on the other side of the pond from me. That's the important part, I guess.
It's dead easy, Vandy. It's halfway between London and Edinburgh.
Okay, good. Well, that really narrowed it down for me. Okay, and also joining us, Akeem, where are we speaking to you from?
Hi, I'm based in Stuttgart, Germany. Mostly known for, you know, fast cars, Mercedes and Porsche, but also for hypervisor software now.
Well, great. Sounds like we've got a great international show here. So I'll get right into it. I went into basically what VirtualBox is about in the beginning of the show, but it was just like the 30-second summary. So would one of you like to take on sort of explaining more about what VirtualBox is about and what you would do with it?
Sure. So VirtualBox is a hypervisor, and a hypervisor lets you run multiple virtual machines at the same time on the same piece of hardware. Now, the difference between VirtualBox and kind of other hypervisor technologies is that VirtualBox extends the operating system of your existing system. So if you've got an Apple Mac like I have, or you have a Windows PC, or you have a Linux server, VirtualBox, when you add it, just like an application, it would extend the capabilities of that platform so that you could then run multiple operating systems at the same time. So it's not a case of wiping the machine clean and installing some kind of bare metal software. It makes it very easy to just install, create VMs, and hey presto, you've got the world at your fingertips.
Now, so this would be the same thing if I called it a virtual machine, you wouldn't be offended by that term. What's the difference between a hypervisor and a virtual machine, or is that really two different words for the same thing?
Yeah, well, a hypervisor is the thing that the virtual machines sit on.
Oh, okay. I guess that clarifies it a little bit. Cool. So how did VirtualBox come to exist, and how long has it been around?
I'll let Akim answer that because he has a longer history than I can.
Cool.
It actually started around 2000. That was shortly after VMware released their first product, VMware Workstation 1.0. We were working on a product which is now called Microsoft Virtual PC. Mm-hmm. Back then, it was owned by a company called Kinectix. They were famous for things like PlayStation emulator on the Macintosh. Mm-hmm. This got acquired by Microsoft, and then our team started to do like the next generation, which became VirtualBox. The project really started in 2004. Mm-hmm. We made it open source, so available to everyone in the world in 2007, and then Sun Microsystems in 2008 acquired VirtualBox. And now the latest change is that Oracle acquired Sun, and now it's Oracle VirtualBox. It's still the same team.
Yeah. Now, in 2007, who were the other players? I think VMware was out there, and you had open source solutions like Xen. Is that sort of the playing field? And then what would make you decide to make VirtualBox open source at that point?
Yeah, the only real player in the commercial sphere was VMware. Microsoft had acquired Kinectix, but they hadn't really digested everything at this point, so there was no offering from Microsoft. There wasn't any real competition in terms of monetizing hypervisors in the PC sphere. There was a company called Parallels that appeared a little bit later. There was Xen, a company called Xen Source formed around Xen. They just picked up funding, and Xen was a big hype back then. But the only real player was VMware, and also a big difference is Andy said that VirtualBox allows you to run virtual machines on your existing computer. You don't have to remove your operating system. Things like Xen, they basically dominate your system, so you can't just install Xen on top of your Windows PC. And VirtualBox really found a niche there that it was like the other product that could be installed on an existing computer. We were a small company back then. We were less than 20 people. We were internally funded. We didn't have all the marketing bucks required to create a worldwide awareness. So we decided we use open source. If it's free, then it's easier for people to give it a try. And that was very successful. It didn't take long until we had millions of users. And this also helped us to generate demand. It was a very well thought out step, because if you do go open source, you can also lose a lot, right? People see all your source code that you invest a lot of money in. People might not even care about it, just use your source code and you don't really make any money. So yeah, open source really was like the tipping point for VirtualBox.
So again, just to kind of make it clarify again, so what this actually lets me do is allows me to, here I am on my OS X desktop, my laptop, and I've installed VirtualBox, and I get essentially a virtual machine running inside that that's like a 386 machine or a maybe a more modern processor than that. I don't know much about Intel processors, amazingly enough. But somehow, it's like a bare machine. I can actually then boot my FreeBSD install disk or my Windows install disk, or maybe even my OS X installed disk, and be able to put it inside there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it also fully abstracts the hardware from the operating system. Like Windows doesn't like if you change the hardware. You can't take a hard disk from one Dell computer, put it in an HP computer that easily. But the virtual machine always has the same virtual hardware. So it doesn't matter where you run it. that's a big advantage because your operating system images, they become portable. They are stored in the container file. You can put it on a USB stick and, you know, take it with you.
And so another advantage of that, yeah, like I think you were just getting at that, and I was just about to ask about that, is that I can take, you know, once I've built this VirtualBox image, whatever it is, it's really a virtual machine that I could then take that exact thing and take it over to a Windows machine that's running VirtualBox or to a Linux machine that's running VirtualBox, and it would just come up not even aware of its outsides, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The operating system inside doesn't really know that it's running the virtual machine, or it doesn't even know that it's running on, you know, a Macintosh. That's another big advantage. And also, it has no way of interfering with your software that you installed on your Mac, for example. Meaning, if you surf the web and you get some malicious software, it will be restricted to within the virtual machine. It can't really reach your system around it. So one of my favorite use of virtual machines is like safe browsing. If I use the browser in the virtual machine, then I'm sure that my, you know, Mac will not be infected by anything.
I'm very interested that you talked about the success of going open source there, Achim. I note that the business model that you seem to have used for VirtualBox right from the beginning was what is now being described as an open core approach, where you have an open source edition which lacks important functions, and then a proprietary version which has got all the added stuff on there. I also note that you've got a huge user community out there, something like 28 million users. How would you say going open source worked for you in the open core sense? Have you been able to get very many other co-developers in that community with you?
Yeah, the open core model, we initially chose it because when we went open source, we really had no idea what would happen. We had like three scenarios. First one was, we go open source, nobody cares. That's like the open source graveyard. A lot of, you know, abandoned products get abandoned the day they become open source. The second thing is, people see our source code and they say, oh, great source code, let's take bits and pieces. And the third option was, you know, we create a vibrant community and we become successful. We didn't know which would be the outcome. So it's kind of a little protection. We held back some parts of the IP that we consider to be really unique. And over time, we released more of that to the open source. So basically, the business model doesn't really require closed source anymore. It's still there for historical reasons. And it also depends on the company policy. And there are some differences between, you know, how things are viewed at Sun and what the policy is like at Oracle.
Would you consider getting rid of that difference between the closed and the community edition now? Because, you know, it seems to me to be something of an anomaly that you've still got it there.
Well, I think the team has been willing to do that for quite some time. It is a lot more open source than used to be. Right now, there are basically only two features that we hold back that are closed source. So for the business model, it's not required to hold back to use this open core model. It works without that because the software is sufficiently complex. And if you really build a business on VirtualBox, which is what we want to charge for, then there is value that, you know, Oracle can provide support and you know, indemnification, all these things. So if you make money using VirtualBox, then normally you're willing to pay us. So we don't need to hold back features to make you pay for them.
So how is life going inside Oracle for you these days? Because, you know, I'm spotting from the Open Solaris community that life is very different in Oracle to how it was in Sun. And it isn't immediately obvious how VirtualBox fits into Oracle's worldview. Would you like to say something about how good a fit VirtualBox is in Oracle's portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, and when this acquisition was announced, we were in the same situation as all the other product team at Sun. We were kind of anxious what would Oracle think about our product. Luckily, Oracle are very keen on VirtualBox. In the initial, you know, we just bought Sun and this is what we're going to do type of executives broadcast, they did mention VirtualBox. They committed to developing VirtualBox. So for us, really, not much has changed. The development team is still the same. The roadmap hasn't really changed. Of course, there's some some minor things like Oracle is different process for all kinds of things. But Oracle is very interested in having a client-side hypervisor. Oracle is very interested in the VirtualBox technology to leverage in other places. For example, the VDI product. Just today, there was an announcement of a new version, major update 3.2, Oracle VDI. That's for running, you know, hundreds and thousands of desktops in a corporate environment hosted in a data center. And there's some other projects going on. So not a lot has really changed. My engineers, they hardly notice anything. I notice changes because, you know, we have now different websites that we use for workflow and all these kind of things. But Oracle is really committed to VirtualBox. And we're still, you know, moving forward, cranking out new releases. We just did an update, was it last week? And we're continuing.
Right. So, I'm sure lots of people in the community are going to be really thrilled to hear that Oracle is still committed to looking after VirtualBox, because you have a huge community. I know. How big would you say your community was now at the moment?
Andy, I think you've got the numbers.
Yeah, just because I was curious, just before the show started, I did a quick kind of query on our database, and we've had we're a whisker short of 30 million downloads right now. And then also we've got basically active users. There's ways that we can kind of like manipulate the data to find out how many active users there were. And that's in the millions, you know, millions of active users every day are using VirtualBox, and that's really reassuring.
Right. And how big is the development team on there for that you're using to sustain that community?
Oracle employed team is around 25 people. There are people outside Oracle that work in VirtualBox. Sometimes they just translate it to some language. Sometimes they really do some major work. It's a very complex piece of software, so there's quite a steep learning curve.
Do you have very many community co-developers in that community? So, you know, as opposed to people who tinker with the documentation or translations, do you have any core developers who are not employed by Oracle?
Yes, but obviously they are just a few. The more than 90% of the core product development work happens at Oracle. That's also due to the core this core process, because not everything is visible to the community. But we've seen a huge increase in community participation and really submitting code as of lately.
You had a point, Andy.
You know, I was going to add there, Simon, that... you know, I'm a relative newcomer to the VirtualBox world. I joined when Sun acquired the business. And one of the first things that struck me about the development model of the VirtualBox team and how they architected the product is that everything has an API. There are APIs and APIs and APIs. And one of the things that facilitates is this ability for people to embed VirtualBox in their solution by talking to an API without necessarily having to, you know, tie it tightly into the source code itself. And a great example of that is just last week or the week before, a guy has developed a PHP-based web console for VirtualBox. So if you go to code.google.com, look for PHP VirtualBox, I believe it is. This guy has developed a really impressive web console for when you run VirtualBox on a server and need to, you know, instantiate, create, launch VMs on a server. And we didn't know this guy from scratch. You know, this guy came from nowhere and produced this really good thing because we enabled the APIs to allow him to develop his application and talk directly to us without necessarily getting dirty with the lines of code that the VirtualBox developers develop. So the community or the ecosystem is bigger than people who contribute code to the open core.
That's really exciting to hear that.
That's a good thing because, you know, I think that our security in VirtualBox as a community is very much proportional to the diversity that you're able to bring into that community. So the more diversity and true self-funded diversity you're able to bring in, the happier we're all going to be about the future of what you're doing. Sorry to cut across you there, Randall.
Yeah, no worries. Good points there. Good points all. Hey, so I'm actually curious. I You brought up the Kinectics product where you would emulate the, I think it was the Atari console, or not the Atari console, what am I thinking, the PlayStation console on a Mac. And I remember playing with that, and one of the things that I learned about it is that it was emulating the machine, so you were basically running a lot slower, but fast enough on modern hardware that it was the same, you know, it was fast enough to be like the game is. But I understand that you're not actually emulating with this thing. You're actually running the instructions at full speed. And how is that possible? I mean, how would it handle like system IO and stuff? Wouldn't that cause it to write directly to registers that you don't want it to write to? Either of you guys.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, the PlayStation was a totally different CPU architecture than the Macintosh, which was PowerPC back then. So you had to translate everything. The two environments had nothing in common. And the same was true for running, you know, Windows on a Mac back when the PowerPC day. So it was slow.
Mm-hmm.
If you run x86 or Intel on Intel, then you don't have to translate everything. And over time, there were different techniques. Like VMware, they always analyzed all the code of the virtual machine, and then they emitted different code on the fly. That's called binary translation. Mm-hmm. That is a very difficult way of doing things because you need to, you know, understand every code in every situation and mimic every behavior of the x86 CPU, which is a very complex CPU. So VirtualBox, just because we were a small team, we had to go for something, I would say, you know, easier. So we went for something what we call the raw mode execution. We basically executed code as is and only did what we call in situ patching, just identified places that need a little help, and the hypervisor mm-hmm. would, you know, rewrite them on the fly. But basically the code would be still in place. The memory layout would not change. And when you said, you know, like it's messing with registers and so on. So what a hypervisor does, it switches context. It switches the computer from one context, which is the normal one you use for your main operating system, to a guest operating system context. So your complete operating system gets swapped out, basically. And then your guest operating system gets swapped in under control of the hypervisor. And mm-hmm. then next time, you know, after couple of microseconds, your main operating system gets swapped in again. You don't see any of that. But that's basically what's happening. The hypervisor is taking over your system. But then a couple of years ago, Intel and AMD introduced virtualization aids to their CPUs. Intel called it VTX. AMD called it AMDB for virtualization. And that makes it a lot easier. So VirtualBox, the core of VirtualBox, was a lot more complex when we started. We still have this old mode in place. You can disable hardware virtualization. There's a checkbox in the GUI. But mm-hmm. normally you would enable it because, A, it typically gives us better speed for modern CPUs, not for the first couple of generations because Intel didn't really get it right in the beginning. And most importantly, it's more robust than our old method. Our old method was optimized for like Windows, Linux. But if you ran like some BSD, whatever version we didn't really test well, then there could be some issues. And with a new method, the hardware virtualization, it's a lot more robust. So almost everything runs flawlessly.
Very cool. Very cool. Because I know that, so my impression from playing with VirtualBox for a bit is that when I build a virtual machine, it seems to be running at almost the native speed of my hardware, even for things that I would sort of consider graphics intense, not like a game or something, but like, you know, most of the sort of just standard display screen stuff. Is there access? Again, I'm not a hardware guy, but I'm thinking there's these things called GPUs inside there to do the real graphics. Are you allowing the software to get to those things through the virtual system?
We do not directly allow the guest to talk to the graphics card. So you wouldn't install an NVIDIA driver in the virtual machine. You would install the VirtualBox driver. But the VirtualBox driver supports OpenGL and Direct3D. And the way we do this is we basically tunnel the 3D commands to the host graphics card. There have been some attempts in the industry to enable graphics card virtualization, but the industry is still a long way. It still has a long way to go. That will take a couple of years. Graphics cards are, you know, more complex than CPUs these days, and right now, there's no built-in support for virtualization yet. With the current version of VirtualBox, you can do OpenGL 2.something. You can do Direct3D. And the beauty is that we abstract everything using OpenGL. So you can run a Windows virtual machine and use Direct3D on a Macintosh host, even though the Macintosh doesn't support Direct3D, because we translate Direct3D to OpenGL on the fly.
Nice, nice. And since we're talking about the hardware that this thing emulates or imagines to the guest operating system, what are some of the other hardware things that are emulated, and what's the trickiest one of those?
So when you provide virtual hardware, you basically have two choices. First is you emulate something that operating systems know about. For example, an Adaptex SCSI controller. Then guest operating systems, they know the device, they bring drivers, and they just work. The second option is you create something yourself. Let's say the VirtualBox storage controller. But then you have to write a device driver for every operating system you want to support. It's a lot of work. So we try to choose devices that operating systems know. And their devices are very different in their quality. Some device might be very inefficient to virtualize. For example, the Adaptex SCSI controller is a nightmare to virtualize. You wouldn't want to choose it because it will be very slow. So what we had to do is choose the virtual hardware in a smart way. A, choose it so that most operating systems know about it, and B, that it's efficient to virtualize. For network cards, we started with the AMD PCNet. That's like the least common denominator. All the operating systems support that card. I think the last hardware was built like 15 years ago. It's really old. Yeah. But it's a very efficient card to virtualize, or relatively efficient. The second one, which is now like the standard VirtualBox, is the E1000, the Intel Gigabit card. That is also fairly well supported. We can actually emulate a couple of variants. Some operating systems only support one variant, but not the other. And then as of lately, we adopted the VirtIO network support, which is something from the KVM world. It's a fully virtual network card that the only purpose is supporting a hypervisor. And it's part of the Linux kernel. So we picked that up and support it. And in the future, we want to improve the performance on this. Storage was also very tricky because, storage, you have to process a lot of data. If you have to touch all this data and rewrite it, adopt it, that costs you a lot of overhead. So we implemented Serial ATA. We're actually the only product that does Serial ATA. Serial ATA SATA is basically SCSI. And this allows us to take the commands from the guest and basically just route them to the host operating system. Don't touch the data at all in between. So we get almost native performance there. And we just added SAS, the latest version, Serial Attached SCSI. It's almost the same as SATA. It supports more disk and stuff like that. But the really important thing is that we don't have to touch the data, don't have to copy it.
Mm-hmm.
And network. And disk, I think, were pretty much the best product on the market in terms of disk performance. Mm-hmm. Network, that's still an area where we think VMware got a lead. So we're totally focused on network performance right now.
Mm. And one of the things I thought was interesting was that the interface allowed me to set it up so that the virtual DVD drive was mapped to my physical DVD drive in my laptop. So when I insert a real DVD, the virtual system would be informed that, oh, here's a DVD that you might want to read. And I thought that was sort of, and you also do that same kind of mapping for USB and maybe a few other things as well?
Yeah, we did this bridging or pass-through support for DVDs. Basically, we kind of just tunnel the commands, but we actually do a sanity test. So if your guest starts, flashing the firmware of your DVD drive, we will actually not allow that. For USB, we allow you to capture USB devices. So a USB device can only be operated by a single device driver. So if you attach it to a virtual machine, your host operating system will give it up, and then the driver will load in the virtual machine. That works fairly well. So you can put in a USB whatever, a USB stick and attach it to a virtual machine, it would disappear from your host operating system. It would pop up in your guest. Mm-hmm. Other pass-through, we can do a disk pass-through, so you can have a virtual machine directly write to a block device, so to a partition or to a whole disk, instead of, you know, being a container file in your host file system.
Right,
that saves some overhead, but it's a lot less practical.
The other thing I saw that was interesting about configuring is that there's different software network modes I could work in. Like I could either work bridge to my standard interfaces, or I could work NAT or have connection only to the local host. And I think that's sort of interesting, especially if you're talking about something like, you know, if I want to run Windows inside my Mac, I might not necessarily want it to have network access so it can pick up viruses and things.
Yeah, there are a couple of networking modes for different scenarios. If you're like the typical Oracle software sales rep, you have like multi-tier applications that you sell. And if you want to demo that, you probably don't want to bring 5 servers. So you can create a virtual machine that runs the Oracle database. You have another virtual machine that runs the BA web application server. And you connect those two. But you're just on your laptop, so you don't really have a big network. You don't have a lot of IP addresses. So you can use the internal networking. That's like an internal channel that only exists between virtual machines. You don't see it on your host operating system. You don't see the external network. And then we have something called the host-only mode. That's something that allows you to run a server in a virtual machine, even though you don't have an IP address on your physical network. Like the sales rep, he would have to make the web server available under an IP address. So the host-only network mode creates an IP interface on your host with a configurable IP address, and that one is reachable just from that computer. And of course, in addition to those two modes, the internal one and the host-only, you have the standard one, which is NAT, network address translation. That's like just the mode that always works, right? Your guest can access the internet, but it cannot be accessed from the internet. And then in addition to that, the most powerful mode is what we call the bridged mode that makes your virtual machine show up as a full system on the network, even though, you know, it doesn't have its own cable. But that requires you to get a real IP address. And that also means it can be reached from outside and probably, you know, not possible in your environment. So we don't default to that. We choose NAT because that just always works.
Cool. Very cool.
Right. Akeem, one of the things that I would love to be able to do with VirtualBox, and I'm a huge VirtualBox fan. I've been running it for a long time now. One of the things I've heard several people say that they would like to be able to do is put together a virtual machine on their desktop environment and then upload it to a hosting service like Amazon Web Services or like Joyent, and just be able to press a button and have it running. Is that one of the directions that you're hoping you're going to take VirtualBox, or is that completely out of scope for you?
Okay, that one is a hard one to answer. You might remember Sun acquired a company called QLayer in 2009. That was the last acquisition. There was a blog from the Sun CEO that showed VirtualBox with an upload to the cloud button. But, you know, things changed. So at this point, there's no solution from Sun. And the other solutions out there, they are very different. There's no real standard. The standard that is there is called OVF, Open Virtual Format. That's supported by VirtualBox. That's like a very thin and very, I would say, shallow way of describing a virtual machine in a cross-platform way. But it doesn't really allow for compatibility yet. You can export and import those OVF appliances in VirtualBox. That's fully implemented. You go to the file menu, say export appliance, choose your virtual machine, and then it gets exported in a format that VMware can read. But in terms of clouds, there are products, there are customers that use VirtualBox for this. We are working to enable interoperability between Oracle VM Server, which is Xen-based, and VirtualBox in the future version. But in order to be able to just upload it to Amazon, you know, Amazon, they use their own version of Xen, which is kind of an old, very old version of Xen, or Join, that use a totally different platform. That's just not feasible yet.
One of the good things that's going on, though, is that Joyent and also Rackspace have been getting together and starting this open cloud initiative. And I don't know whether there is scope for you to join in with, OpenStack it's called. I don't know whether there's scope for you to join in with OpenStack and use that as the vehicle through which you can begin to disrupt the hosting market and have VirtualBox supported. Because there's a lot of us out here who would love to see that capability come into existence. We're really rather sick of using non-free software to do our hosting.
That is very tempting. We've looked into OpenStack, and we would certainly like to see that happen. Actually, VirtualBox has an EC2 appliance upload feature. It's undocumented. We implemented it, hoping for the Sun cloud. You might remember that, Simon.
I do remember that very clearly, the Sun cloud that unfortunately, I don't know what happened. It's normally the cloud goes in front of the Sun. I don't know what happened there. But, you know, where is that feature? Is there some undocumented documentation that we could surreptitiously discover?
I think it's a part of the syntax diagram. VBox Manage, that's like the Swiss Army knife for VirtualBox. You can do whatever you want to do with VirtualBox with this command line interface. There's a VBox Manage export, and mm-hmm. that one supports EC2 as a storage protocol. That's the it's called S3, right? The Amazon storage protocol. So you can upload a VirtualBox VM to an Amazon bucket.
So we would dearly love to see that. I mean, you know, speaking for myself rather than for loads of people in the community, but I'm sure we would dearly love to see that happen. Well, Randall, we'll have to get on to Rick Clark, who was on Floss Weekly 2 weeks ago, and suggest that to him, I think.
Clearly, it sounds like a great thing to do there. So I have only maybe a couple more questions about the technology, because I'm fascinated with the geek stuff. That's just who I am. This term paravirtualization comes up a couple of times. Is that something we've already covered, or is it a variant of what you've already talked about?
Yeah, I think paravirtualization just refers to defining interfaces between the virtual machine and the virtual hardware that are different from, you know, what a physical PC would show you. So instead of having an Intel Gigabit Ethernet card and using Intel's driver, you use something like VirtIO, which is just a virtual interface. Some years ago, you know, people believed that the only way to achieve good performance was to use paravirtualization all over. Like Xen supports a paravirtualized kernel, which is a very different kernel, right? A Linux kernel that is a ZenPV kernel is very different from a standard Linux kernel. Nowadays, the consensus is more that, you know, you do paravirtualization in some places, like for network devices, but you don't really do a lot of invasive changes to guest operating systems. Because the biggest advantage of virtualization is that you just take your existing stuff and put it in a virtual machine. You don't modify it.
And that would be different from, say, something like, is LVM something that would be paravirtualized? I stumble across those letters from time to time.
Sorry, which product?
Is LVM, the Linux virtual machine, LVM, does that mean anything? Maybe I'm mixing up all my stuff. I'm going to seem silly to the Linux community again for not knowing all the stuff.
KVM, probably.
Oh, KVM, KVM. Yeah. I had successor, L, I added one to it. Okay, go ahead. What is KVM? How does that compare to this?
Well, KVM is more like VirtualBox in that regard. I think the biggest representative of a paravirtualization is Xen, let's say the paravirtualized Xen. There's no a full system virtualization Xen as well.
Now, does VirtualBox only come in like hosted mode? So, I mean, I would run it with, say, Linux, or I'd run it with OS X. What are some of the other platforms it runs on? And is there no equivalent to the bare metal version like you would have for VMware?
Yeah, so VirtualBox is what people often call a type 2 hypervisor or a hosted hypervisor. So it runs on Windows, Linux, Mac OS X, Solaris, and FreeBSD. But FreeBSD is community supported, not Oracle supported. There was a time when people said that only type 1 hypervisors, so the bare metal hypervisors, can deliver performance. But those days are luckily over because we've always claimed that this is not true. If you do a bare metal product, you have to deliver all the code that makes this bare metal work. Basically, the code that makes bare metal boot and work is called an operating system. So if you make your hypervisor work in bare metal, you basically deliver it with an operating system. What most people did, even VMware, they took a Linux and they stripped it down and modified to their needs. VirtualBox does not want to do this. We think that everything can be achieved, or pretty much everything can be achieved, with a hosted solution. And thanks to KVM, which has gained a lot of traction lately, people are more and more agreeing to that position.
Cool. Hey, one of the things I also saw as I was installing, trying to install FreeBSD, by the way, I failed. I do not understand sysinstall. I need to get Randy back on the show and scream at her for sysinstall. But one of the things I saw was this slider. I have an i7 modern MacBook Pro, and there was a slider that said I could actually emulate 4 processors or even up to 8, although it went past 4 and it started saying don't do that. So. So is this really exposing then running on multiple threads, multiple cores, right down into the VM?
Virtual SMP support was one of the most difficult features. It took us like 6 months to develop and 1.5 years to get it stable.
I can imagine.
If you have multiple CPUs in your host system, and depending on what other workloads you're running, whatever other virtual machines, our virtual machines actually run multiple CPUs in parallel. The reason we can actually emulate more virtual CPUs than you have physical CPUs is that we simply do not guarantee that all of them are scheduled at the same time. But that's even true for a physical system, because like my iMac, Core i7 shows 8 CPUs, even though it only has 4 cores. It has hyper-threading, which are kind of virtual CPUs. They're just there to better utilize the processing units in the cores. So the same is basically for VirtualBox. If you have 2 cores on your host and you assign 4 to a virtual machine, then you're kind of comparable to a hyper-threading setup. And operating systems generally do not assume that all cores are executing instructions at the same time.
Okay. One of the things I saw that you added recently was this notion of live migration. Do you want to describe what that is and why that would be cool?
Well, live migration is kind of old style. What we do is called teleportation.
Ooh, okay. Even better.
Yeah, teleportation... allows you to, I'm not going to talk about, what it does with matter. But in a virtual machine context, it allows you to take a virtual machine that's running on one computer and have it jump over to another computer, which is just connected via standard network, TCP/IP. And what's special about teleportation is that these two computers don't have to be identical. For classical live migration, you basically need to order 2 units of the same computer, like 2 Dell servers, exact the same model, buy them at the same time, so you get the same CPUs and other chips in there. Mm-hmm. And teleportation, before we released it, we actually had a little game in the office. So we had a virtual machine, it was a Windows machine playing a YouTube video, and the goal was to have it teleport to each developer's desktop. And once it arrives back at the original, was my lead architect's desktop, then we passed the test. So it started on his Windows machine. It went over to our Solaris engineer, continued to a MacBook, and went to Linux and came back to Windows.
Wow.
So that's the big advantage of teleportation. We do this because we abstract a lot of the hardware. So if you jump from like an Intel Mac to an AMD Windows machine, we make that invisible to the guest.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So how this would work then is that you kind of bring up the second machine and you kind of get it like mostly in sync, and then you finally just quit the first one when you're mostly hooked up. Is that how it works?
Exactly the way it works, yes.
Well, very cool. So this would be great, for example, and say something like, EC2, I know that I have the problem, or at least they promised me a certain level of number of nines of uptime. But they do say that we may have to take your server down from time to time, that just there's nothing, we can't do anything about that. And we'll reboot you because we hope that you survive a reboot. But we basically have to take you down. So if you had something like teleportation, you'd be able to actually live migrate it to another another box, and without even, and I wouldn't even notice with the right front end traffic directory, I wouldn't even necessarily notice that my TCP/IP connections would stay up then, right?
If your switch, if your switch is smart enough, some cheap switches would. If you can have switch from one port to another because you're on a different machine, some cheap switches would not understand that, but typically it would just work, yeah.
Cool.
What we really, really tried with teleportation is, we wanted to be like the Henry Ford. We wanted to make this high-end feature easy and affordable. VMware, who introduced vMotion some years ago, That's a rather complicated and demanding feature. So we really wanted to make this easy and don't require a lot of resources and make it very compatible. Don't require people to have identical machines. And the main use case, as you said, is taking a server down, or if you have like 10 servers, but you only need two at night because most of your staff are home, then you can just migrate the machines to those two, turn off the others, and before they come in the morning, move the machines back. There are lots of smart use cases for that feature.
Mm. Cool.
Mm. So, Andy, you're way up there in Leeds. Actually, I'm interested that this Floss Weekly is all Europeans apart from Randall, because I'm here down in Southampton in the south of England. Andy, I was going to ask you, tell us about what's coming up next for VirtualBox. A lot of us are familiar with running it to solve our problem of not wanting to have a Windows system in the house anywhere. What else is coming up on the VirtualBox roadmap that we ought to get excited about?
Okay, well, we're continuing our theme of just making it bigger, stronger, faster, because VirtualBox is not only used client-side on, for instance, our Macs, Windows, PCs that we talked about, but also on the servers as well. So it can run on Solaris servers, Linux servers, Windows servers. And in fact, it's used as the engine, as Akin mentioned earlier, that underpins the VDI product that is a new Oracle product released. Oracle VDI 3.2 was released just today. And some of the new functionality that we put into VirtualBox is to support that use case where you're running many, many virtual machines on servers at the back end. And part of the trick to making that work particularly well is how can you squeeze more and more virtual machines onto a given piece of hardware? And you've seen the first phase of what we've tried to do in the for instance, the 3.2 release, which is the one that's currently shipping, in that we've introduced certain memory optimization techniques such as Page Fusion, which is really neat, actually. Let me just take a little time out to talk about Page Fusion, because what we're doing with Page Fusion is we're basically saying, hey, if you're running, say, 100 Windows XP virtual machines on your server, aren't there going to be lumps of data that are identical there? When you run, for instance, just a simple case of two Windows XP virtual machines, aren't there going to be pages or lumps of memory containing, for instance, the Windows operating system code, various DLLs, that are going to be identical there? And is there some way that you can kind of get them to be shared? So that's the idea behind Page Fusion. And the reason why it's different from what people have typically called page sharing is that the approach that we used there was we used a little bit of intelligence inside the guest. So what happens inside the guest is the guest is the Windows XP system. The guest basically says to the VirtualBox hypervisor, hey, he's just about to load nt.dll. And when each VM passes that information and tips off the hypervisor can say, just a minute, let me just see if we've got one of them already that can be shared. And the net result of this is that you can get more virtual machines onto less memory. You can also make them work. Typical page sharing techniques are very kind of computationally expensive because you have to make sure each of these pages is exactly the same by running various, you know, hashing algorithms on them or whatever. Whereas this tip-off technique is a way of more rapidly being able to eliminate pages. So that's kind of unique. And we'll continue doing things like that. I guess in terms of one of the big challenges Akin mentioned was in providing better multimedia kind of capabilities. The approach we take right now is where we intercept these multimedia calls from the guest, we translate them into typically OpenGL, and we leverage the power of the local system, which may have a GPU in, to kind of get the optimum performance for 3D and video type applications. And we'll continue to do that with stuff like, for instance, Windows 7 uses the Aero model, which we currently don't support very well right now. So we'll be much better at supporting Aero. We'll be much faster in terms of networking, as Akin said earlier on. And we'll be able to approach the challenge of squeezing more VMs onto a given piece of hardware.
And Andy, there's been a question come in on the IRC chat that a lot of people would like to know. One of the reasons I run VirtualBox is so I don't have to have a Windows machine in the house. Now that Apple has become evil, a lot of people don't want to run Macs in the house either. Are you going to have the ability for us to virtualize OS X coming up in the future?
Well, you could actually do that today. You know, if you want to run Apple's Mac OS X server, you can do that today. But there is a problem with this in that what Apple have designed into their operating system are certain checks whereby the operating system, Mac OS X, checks on the underlying hardware to see, hey, is this Apple-branded hardware? And so what VirtualBox does in that instance is we pass through those checks because we don't have the Apple system management chip, which is a special piece of hardware which Apple use for bits and pieces. We don't emulate one of them, so we simply pass it through. And if you're on Apple-branded hardware, everything's good because you'll be able to read those registers, get the information back that you need. If you're not on Apple-branded hardware, then those checks will fail and the Mac OS operating system will say, I'm sorry, you know, I can't run this piece of hardware. So you can run Mac OS X on VirtualBox today, but the constraint is it has to be Apple-branded hardware.
So Apple actually puts a bit of DRM in every one of their machines? That's like evil.
Well, that's why we want to virtualize them, you see, Randall, so we don't have to do business with them anymore.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, you know, I shouldn't say that because the last time I even talked about the hardware of my laptop, it decided to crash. So no, nice machine. Thank you, very nice machine. At least let me finish this show. Okay, great. Well, we've talked a lot about, I think we've covered just about everything there is to cover about VirtualBox, but is there anything I sort of left out, Andy or Akin, that you want to make sure we get said to our audience?
Yeah, maybe we talked about a development model in great detail. So while, you know, standard Oracle policy, we can't really talk about our future plans, what we actually do is we make our source code available, you know, every day. Every day when we, you know, check in new features, VirtualBox, fix bugs on the what we call the trunk, which is going to be the next major version, that code becomes available on VirtualBox.org. So basically, everybody can see what's happening. People can compile that. People can contribute to that. Right now, if you download and use that code, it is bleeding edge. It will probably crash your system and corrupt all your virtual machines, etc. But you will see that there is a lot of new stuff in there already. A new user interface, lots of performance improvements. So you can see what's happening on a daily basis. It's not like, you know, big corporation presents magic little thing someday and nobody expected it. It's very transparent, actually.
Cool. I only got one other question. I got reminded by the chat room as well. Emacs or Vi?
I don't like either of them, but I know five commands for Vi, so that usually gets me where I to go.
Okay. What do you normally code in? Are you using like Xcode? No. How do you normally develop this software then?
Well, every engineer uses something else. I think our most sophisticated one is Slick Edit. He's written megabytes of macros. Only he knows how to use it. But everybody uses something else. I kind of use different operating systems, and VI is like the least common denominator. All systems but Windows have VI, so. But I'm not good at remembering all the commands.
Well, all you need to be able to do, I mean, you could edit all your files with cat if you just knew how to type it right the first time. So it's pretty simple to pull text editors out of that. Okay, I'm just rambling now. So I just want to thank both of you guys for coming on and talking about a very useful project, a very useful product, VirtualBox. Definitely a key player in this arena. And like I said, I've played with it from time to time. I also use the other two guys a little bit too, but I'm really happy you guys got to come on and talk today. And thank you for being on the show.
Pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you. So that was Andy Hall, who is the product manager for Oracle VM VirtualBox, and Keem Hassenmuller, who is the former CEO of Innotech, who we actually didn't get into the history of, sorry guys, but well, we did sort of, we covered that the product happened, and he's one of the original creators of VirtualBox. Glad to have him on the show. Simon, any observations from having chatted with these guys for a bit?
Well, I must say how pleased I am that VirtualBox has still got Oracle support. I'm still not completely clear how it's held up, whether it's just held up by art or something, but it seems that it's got a solid future in the Oracle product suite, and that is very gratifying indeed, because there's so many of us in the free software community who depend on it for doing our development and also for running all of the legacy software that we've got to have in there. So I'm very pleased to hear them looking at the features, taking the product forward, being committed to and funded to keep it running. I'd like to see a little bit more community involvement from them, and I would be delighted if they joined that OpenStack initiative, because that would bring some capabilities that we really need. What did you think, Randall?
Well, it sounded like if they were moving towards a model where commits were immediately visible in the public and that people could be much more involved from the outside. So I think maybe while it might have been hard before we got to here, it might actually be better as time moves on, which is going to be pretty cool. I like it. I'm now I want a situation where I get to try out teleportation just because it sounds really cool. So, I did to watch that happen. It would be kind of fun. And again, since as I brought up with EC2, it doesn't work with EC2 doesn't do that for me. So, if they can get that working, especially in some sort of hosted situation where we could have a guaranteed continuous uptime because we just keep moving it around from machine to machine as they die or don't die. So that'd be pretty cool.
Absolutely. Well, if you can get that teleportation working, I've got some coffee running over in the back of the office. So if you want to come up.
Yes, that'd be very good. That'd be very good. And then I would have been in the same time zone as most of you guys. You're right. This was a European show, and here I was stuck over here in LA, on the other end of the spectrum. So very cool. I did want to bring up that we did mention the chat room a couple times in this particular show. I don't always talk about it because we don't always have immediate questions to ask, but if you're around around the internet, whatever that means, at 9:30 on Wednesday mornings Pacific time US, which would be 12:30 Eastern time, and who knows what time in Europe, add 7 or 8 hours to that, I guess. You can actually watch us be doing the show and watch us make all the mistakes and the outtakes that we do, which is a lot of fun. But also there's a chat room, so you can come and talk to us and ask questions of the guests. And I try to keep my eyes down there. You're watching me look down on the video. I'm actually watching the chat room down there to try to get more questions in, because I like the fact that we're able to do this live, and that the Twit Network provides me a place that I can do this live in front of hundreds of people, maybe thousands. I never know. So just wanted to let you know that. Speaking of having guests and coming on at 9:30 in the morning on Wednesdays, let's look at the upcoming list. We have scheduled for next week Stephen Heminger, who has the Viata project, which I understand is a Cisco clone. So if you're used to using the Cisco operating system and you want the interfaces and all the things that it provides, apparently his software is designed to be a drop-in replacement for that in an open source way. We've got Dan Scott, Mike Rylander on the Evergreen Library Project, which is going to be a lot of fun, running your whole library card catalog system using open source software from top to bottom, used in hundreds I'm told, hundreds, maybe even thousands of libraries around the U.S. and around the world. Thomas Cherry Helms is coming on to talk about Linux MCE, which is a home automation system, home everything system, runs your alarm, runs your media center, everything you want to do there. We have a special co-host for that, Scott Wilkinson, who you might have heard here on the Twit Network doing the home theater show. He's going to come on and talk to us about that. I'm just beginning to put together my September and October schedules, so there'll be a lot more guests to talk about next week as I start sending out the thousands of emails that I have to do to take care of that. You can also follow me on Twitter at Merlin, at Merlin. There's my handle there. That's Merlin with a Y. And if you follow me on Merlin, you might actually see that in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be out at Dragon Con with Tom Merritt and Veronica Belmont, who you've heard Tom Merritt on this network a lot. And Leo is sending Tom out. I'm also going to be there because I'm already there anyway. So if you watch that, you'll see maybe I'll get in on some of the live stuff that they're doing. I think that's it for me. Simon, what do you where do we find you coming up, and where do we see you online?
You'll find me at webmink.com. You'll find me on Twitter. My handle is webmink. That's W-E-B-M-I-N-K. Coming up soon is Open World Forum in Paris. And and of course, my phone rings at just that moment.
maybe it's the Open Web Forum. But maybe it's the Open World Forum calling you right now.
Yeah, it could be. So there's also Open World Forum coming up in Paris. That's September 30th, October 1st. It's going to be a really good free software event, and it's also free as in beer. And yes, Twit Engineering, we can do it again.
Once more with feeling. So, Simon, tell us where you're going to be coming up soon. How do people find out about you and where you're going to be?
Well, you can follow my blog ramblings on webmink.com. You can see the URL on the screen there. You can find me on Twitter, where my handle is also webmink. And then also I'm going to be chairing the opening keynote at a great conference in Paris, September 30th, October 1st. There's a conference called Open World Forum. And it is going to be a great conference with a great lineup of speakers. And it is free as in beer. So if you're within striking distance of Paris at the end of September, register for that on the web at openworldforum.org and come along and see us all.
Very good, Simon. I'm sure that everybody will be thrilled and pleased to hear you and see you and chat with you, as I always am when I'm in your gracious presence. It's all very fun to do. So I think we have covered everything there is to cover for this week's show. So I'm just going to wrap it up here, and I'll say, as I always say, we'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.